In a statement he made in 2008, the Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto, internet activist Aaron Swartz addressed the digitizing of public information by corporations that in turn charge for access to what he felt should be available to all for free. He wrote, "There is no justice in following unjust laws. It's time to come into the light and, in the grand tradition of civil disobedience, declare our opposition to this private theft of public culture." In a film called The Internet's Own Boy, it's a new documentary that opens today at the IFC Center, director Brian Knappenberger lays out Aaron Swartz's groundbreaking work as an internet activist, which ended in a 2-year legal battle with the federal government and resulted in his suicide at age 26. I'm very pleased to welcome Brian Knappenberger to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
What is it about Aaron's story that seems to have touched a nerve with people beyond the online community?
Well, it's one of the things I wanted to find out in starting to make this documentary. I was on a panel talking about hackers and hacktivism about a week after Aaron died here in New York City with Aaron's ex-girlfriend, Quinn Norton. And this was at the very beginning of this huge just wave of anger and frustration and sympathy that was coming as a result of his death. So part of the film was trying to understand that very question. Why were so many people responding? And that's part of what started us going.
And blaming the government and MIT and all sorts of other people.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
At the beginning of the film, we see footage from home movies of Aaron Swartz as a 3-year-old. It's quite apparent that he was an exceptional child. When you interviewed his parents, when did they say they first noticed that Aaron was different from other children his
age?
Well,
in the film, they describe being shocked when he asked his mom about something that was written on the refrigerator. And his mom says, "Well, wait, why? How did you know about this?" And he says, "I just read it right here." And so a little 3-year-old that had already had some capacity to read.
He had taught himself how to read.
He had sort of taught himself how to read. And that happens a couple more times in the film. We kind of go over it in a couple funny ways. He's actually contributing in fairly substantive ways to the RSS working group, a group of people online that were talking about the free flow of information, particularly with RSS, coming up with those standards. And here was this kid, they didn't know it was a kid. Here's this colleague that was contributing in a major way.
He's 14 years old.
Right. And then they say, "Well, look, we'd love for you to come out to these face-to-face meetings." And he says, "Well, actually, I'm not sure if my mom would let me. I'm only 14 years old." So they were both shocked and then, of course, wanted to meet him even more.
Did he do well in school?
He did exceptionally well in school, so much so that he got bored with it and ended up dropping out of school and homeschooling during high school, which really, I think, judging by the stories of his brothers and family, amounted to him just sort of self-schooling and really creating the early internet.
A lot of kids were attracted to computers when he was growing up, but he got involved in a much more complex way. He was writing computer code to solve problems from a very early age. He refers to it as magic. When did he come to his realization that he could change the world through writing computer code?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I mean, he did see programming as a kind of magic. And one of the things that his brother says in the film is that he asks the question, well, if you could do magic, what would you do? Right? Would you use it to just make tons and tons of money, or would you do it to actually kind of genuinely solve the problems of the world? And this is something that was clearly on Aaron's mind from a very, very young age, the idea that we live in this new world, and as a coder, as a programmer, you have a certain power in that world, and that it's not enough just to kind of make money with that power, that you can actually use it for in the public interest.
Was that what he was doing when he helped develop the RSS standard?
I think so, yeah. I
mean, how does RSS work?
RSS pulls in, the best example of this is a blog that might pull in updates from a handful of other blogs that continues to update. You send out an RSS feed. Podcasts do this a lot. You do this with podcasts a lot, where you're constantly getting fed the most updated sort of headlines from the New York Times or whatever, that sort of thing. So this is a set of standards that was created by these early working groups, and he was a big contributor to that.
So Huffington Post could not exist without the RSS feed.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's Aaron's fingerprints and those that energy is all through the internet.
As a young teenager, Aaron reached out to Lawrence Lessig.
Yeah.
For those who don't know, who's Lawrence Lessig? For those who didn't hear him when he was on our show.
Was he? I'm sure he was. Yeah. I mean, he's who's Lawrence Lessig? Lawrence Lessig is a sort of a luminary of sorts, certainly at that time in the remix kind of culture movement. He was crafting this set of standards meant to sort of bridge the gap between a content industry increasingly feeling like they needed to prosecute people and feeling like they were losing control over the things that they were creating, and an increasingly chaotic world of piracy. He was crafting Creative Commons, and that's when he connects with Aaron. Aaron becomes the technical architect of Creative Commons.
Because Creative Commons is setting standards, or at least deciding
yeah.
what should be available, what should
yeah, well, Creative Commons is essentially a set of licenses that you can choose. So you're the copyright owner, and you're choosing to license your material in lots of ways that they believed made a lot more sense for the internet. So you're choosing between a commercial, non-commercial, share alike, which means anybody that shares your work has to share it in the same terms that you've licensed it. Attribution means they have to give you attribution, or not. You can choose to say, no, you can just share my work without it. There's hundreds of millions of people use this on Flickr every day. It's been a way around an attempt at a path through this kind of world of sharing in the internet.
Aaron went to Stanford, which is where so many of the computer geniuses have gone. I guess we could call him a genius. How old was he when he entered Stanford?
Good question. I think he was 18.
What was the experience like for him?
He was bored. I mean, I think he was, you know, people in the film, they describe him as being very excited to get to college. I think he was bored with the kind of school. He was frustrated with school, certainly in high school and before. And I think there was a moment where he saw Stanford and college as this place where he could, you know, he could do scholarship. He could finally dig in and kind of explore the world of academia in the way that he wanted to. And he found that he found that other students weren't as interested in that kind of scholarship as they were more interested in partying. There's a number of blogs that he posts that he was a very prolific writer. And that just describes a frustration with not being enough for him. So he drops out.
Or was kind of kicked out, wasn't he?
Actually, in Stanford, he was – no, he wasn't kicked out. He was accepted to be a part of Paul Graham's famous Y Combinator series. He's one of the first people to be accepted into that series. So he sees this as a way out. He goes there in the summer, and he really doesn't plan to go back to Stanford.
My guest is Brian Knappenberger. His film, The Internet's Own Board, The Story of Aaron Swartz, opens today at the IFC Center here in New York. So he joins a company that later merges with Reddit.
Yeah.
When Condé Nast bought Reddit, Aaron found himself working in the corporate world.
That's right.
He wasn't happy at Stanford University.
That's right.
High-tech university. How did he respond to being in the corporate world?
Very similarly. It didn't sit well with him. He and the other partners sell Reddit to Condé Nast. It makes him a very rich 19-year-old. And yet he also has to move to San Francisco. He's in the kind of Condé Nast wired offices there. And he is talking about how kind of bored and kind of throttled he feels. You know, he gets sick of another video game review and another gadget review. And he really wants to – you really sense this desire to move into social justice issues, to move into like political organizing, to a hunger there that just wasn't satisfied by those environments.
There are many instances of young, brilliant programmers and internet visionaries who have formed startups and then made millions. Very few of them went the route of Aaron Swartz.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very. It's a big part.
Most of them were happy to make the millions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then
buy
football teams.
Totally. And there's, I think nobody can look at Aaron's story and think that he couldn't have been one of those people. But one of the powerful parts of his story to me is this decisive turn he takes around that when he breaks from Reddit Condé Nast and really decides to go into political organizing and social justice issues. I mean, most people, let's face it, get into the Silicon Valley startup culture, get on the treadmill, and just want to keep doing the same thing. He decisively decides not to do that. He saw Silicon Valley kind of as a machine for making money. And, you know, there's a cliche in Silicon Valley, you know, to make the world a better place. Well, Aaron said, well, do you know what makes the world bad to begin with? And if so, are you how are you devising a plan to solve that problem? And then when you try to solve that problem, are you measuring the impact you're going to have? You know, once you start asking those questions or have the intellectual curiosity to ask those questions, you've kind of ripped the veil from aside the kind of Silicon Valley kind of nonsense, right?
So he became more interested in social justice and ensuring that everyone had equal access to information. Mm-hmm. We're still debating that.
Yeah, we are.
Congress or the president may very well make decisions along those lines very soon.
Yeah.
And it looks like nobody's going to be happy.
Right. Well, we have a very odd situation in this country where a lot of times academics and researchers some of the great minds of our time work on papers, work on research, and then they have to hand over those copyrights to these companies, JSTOR and Reed Elsevier and others.
But they do the research on the taxpayers' dollars.
Plus
they?
They're being paid. Yeah, absolutely.
Should just be available to everybody. We paid for it. We should be able to get it.
You sound like an open access advocate. That's exactly the idea. That's what offends so many people. And I think that was one of the things. You read a brief bit of the Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto, something that Aaron signed his name to in 2008. And that's essentially what it is. That's essentially that perspective.
A couple of years before that, 2006, he formed the Open Library. What was his vision for that online project?
To have a copy of a book online, every book ever made, at least if not the public domain copy of the book, then a way to get it. So a cataloged library of
different than of what books. Google has been doing.
Different in this, yeah, yes, different. It comes from a similar period of time and a similar desire, but I think what they wanted to do is that where you could buy it, or you could borrow it, or you could locate a kind of a directory of books online.
We really begin to see the evolution of his thinking and his politicization as he takes on something called PACER.
Yeah.
What's PACER and what about it spurred Aaron to action?
Yeah, PACER is the Public Access to Court Electronic Records, which is essentially where we as a country, we keep our court documents. So court cases happen every day and these documents are created, also funded by taxpayer created documents. And then they're put on PACER in an electronic sense. You can go to the court and get an actual physical copy, but the electronic copy is PACER. A lot of people are offended that PACER, you have to pay money. You have to pay 10 cents a page in order to get these court documents. It's also – I mean, I as a journalist use it to look up court cases all the time, and it's actually an awful system. It's a terrible – not exactly user-friendly. Let's put it that way. And these are court documents. This is the law in practice, right? I mean, you can look at what the laws are, but you don't really know the law until you see how it's being used in the courts. So the idea is that it's offensive that these things are locked up behind paywalls, that they've been – they're part of what our government creates with our money. And they're the law. They're the law. What kind of a democracy is it if you have to pay to see the law? So this was offensive to Aaron and some other folks. And so they devise a way to take advantage of a program that's going on in libraries across the country, a very small handful of libraries across the country where they are – you know, PACER's getting a lot of flack for this at this point. And they devise a program where they take advantage of a program where PACER offers some free access to these documents. And I'm not sure they took into account someone with the kind of technical skills that Aaron had. He goes in and he downloads 20 million pages from PACER and he posts them online.
One real victory Aaron experienced was the uprising against the SOPA bill in Congress. What was SOPA and how were Aaron and others able to rally some major online entities to fight it?
Yeah, SOPA is the Stop Online Piracy Act. It came out of a number of acts that content providers were pushing to have enacted that would gum up the workings of the internet in an attempt to solve the problem of piracy. It was a dramatic overreach, or at least that's how most people saw it. And Aaron and others began a fight that just became huge to make sure that this law didn't get passed.
And then, in the spirit of what he did with Pacer, he went after JSTOR.
Yeah.
Now, JSTOR is academic papers and journals, as we said, most often paid for by taxpayer dollars that aren't available for free, mm-hmm. even though – so a company takes them over and charges us how much, 10 cents a page?
No. To get an article, one article on JSTOR, you get $50, $60, $70 an article.
So but they're also made available in some college libraries, so he did the same thing with them at the MIT library and just downloaded a lot of documents?
Yeah. Essentially what he did was he used the MIT network to access JSTOR. He had access to the MIT network, as you or I would. You don't have to be a student. You could just go on the campus. And from MIT, they had access to JSTOR. So that's how he accessed the JSTOR database.
Well, JSTOR dropped its complaint against him, and yet the FBI and the Secret Service came down hard on him.
Yeah, so basically Aaron ended up downloading 4.7 million academic journal articles. And they found out someone was doing this. They took a number of steps to stop him. He used his card of skills to kind of circumvent those steps. Those attempts to block him, and ended up downloading all these articles, and then began a 2-year legal. They arrested him by putting a surveillance camera in a closet, and that became a 2-year legal nightmare. And as you said, JSTOR at one point actually drops charges, but the government's case marches on.
And he was. Although he seems to be really level-headed, he also was obviously troubled on some levels, mm-hmm. and he committed suicide. After that, did MIT or the U.S. government express any misgivings as to having pursued him, threatening him with jail for how many years?
Well, at one point, the press release says $1 million and 35 years in prison, $1 million fine. Did they express regret? No. I mean, not in any kind of substantive way, I would say. I mean, there was a couple of small press releases where they're asked about it, press conferences where they're asked about it. Some sympathy was expressed that they had lost this remarkable person. But, I mean, honestly, they've been so quiet about what they were doing in this case. They've been so silent about what their case would have been. We never had a public trial, so we don't even know why they were pursuing. I mean,
well, I suspect they don't want somebody else to pick up where Aaron left off.
I mean, yeah, checking too many books out of the library. I mean, this is not exactly a criminal hacker here. So it remains an open question why they were going after him, and I think their overwhelming response has just been silence. I think we're owed a little bit more than that.
Brian Knappenberger's film, The Internet's Own Boy, The Story of Aaron Swartz, opens today at the IFC Center in Greenwich Village. Thank you so much for being on our show.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.